Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, 19 March now, 2022. I'm your host, Mark Call. Sometimes I start off our recap of the week that was with a look back chronologically, but this week we're not going to do that simply because the bigger events happened later on, and I'm thinking first, of course, about the Fed's Open Market Committee, which met on Mount Olympus, also known as the Eccles Building. This time, though, really nothing that wasn't already pretty well pre-discounted came out. But still, as telegraphed, their fateful decision to raise interest rates, not as much as everybody that wanted them raised said they needed to raise them, quarter point, but still, it's done. The major consensus seems to be too little too late. I like Peter Schiff's comments. The Federal Reserve, says SchiffGold.com, wrapped up their March meeting, delivering their 25 basis point interest rate hike in the face of a 7.9% CPI, and Peter Schiff called it the most anticipated and probably the most meaningless rate hike in history. There was some speculation the central bank would lift off with a 50 basis point rate hike before Russia invaded Ukraine, but Peter said even then that'd be too little too late to derail this juggernaut of inflation. Nevertheless, the Fed move, pitiful as it was the first salvo in their so-called war on inflation, and while it looks to be kind of a feckless fight, Peter thinks the rate hikes that are already in plan will do more damage to the economy than most people have yet realized. The Fed is talking about up to six more rate hikes this year, taking interest rates to just below 2%, still not particularly significant in light of the historically record high levels of inflation. And the bond market at this point appears to be correctly pricing in a recession, or worse. But Peter says bond buyers are still missing the boat. I agree, he said, bond investors are correct, a recession's coming. But where bond investors are missing the mark is to believe that the arrival of a recession means a departure of inflation. He thinks the recession will simply exacerbate the inflation problem. You've heard the term, folks, stagflation, writing that as the U.S. economy weakens, that's going to put more upward pressure on the budget deficit. The government will then collect less in the way of taxes. It's going to be spending more as these stabilizers kick in while the economy weakens. So the deficits are going to get bigger, which is also going to put more pressure on the U.S. dollar to go down. And as the dollar really starts to fall, that's going to put more upward pressure, imagine this, on prices. And if you consider the massive increases in the money supply compared to price increases that we've seen so far, there's still a long way for prices to run upward. And the well-known Austrian economist also made this point. The Fed's messaging was widely regarded as hawkish, with the Fed chair Powell having firm resolve, they say, to stick to the rate hike path. But Peter picked something up in the Fed minutes most didn't seem to notice. The FOMC took out language relating to the start of their balance sheet reduction, which they now say will just happen sometime in the future. What they now call quantitative tightening, he noted, is happening later than the Fed initially postured. And he adds it may never happen. That's kind of my thought. They can raise interest rates slightly because on the margin, the first few rate hikes won't have much of an impact. But given the enormity of the federal government deficits, I don't see, he continued, how the Fed's going to be able to shrink its balance sheet. In fact, I think the Fed is going to have to continue to increase the size of its balance sheet even as it notches up interest rates. You may have heard the term, folks, buyer of last resort, and that means if nobody else wants the bonds, which tends to happen when they end up paying what amounts to negative real interest rates, guess who's going to end up being on the hook for them? And keep in mind, he concluded, the U.S. economy is a credit bubble. It hinges on the ability of over-leveraged consumers, businesses, and governments to keep on spending money that they don't have for things that they don't need. Well, he calls it borrowed money. And obviously, then there comes a breaking point when it comes to interest rates. You live by low interest rates, you die by high interest rates. So the only question, says Schiff, is when are low interest rates no longer low enough, and then they become high? We're only going to find out when we get there. Yep, your host agrees. I've said this before. Back up until you hear glass breaking. Which leads him to conclude the Fed clearly doesn't even understand that the economy is a bubble. Or if it does, they're sure as hell not going to admit that to anybody. Zero Hedge also had a piece up from QTR's Fringe Finance, which called the outcome from the meeting the worst of all worlds and said that the paralyzed Fed will end up moving too slowly to raise rates. And this, your host thought, was a fairly succinct summary. Do you think, the question was asked, that the Fed is going to be able to deal with inflation underneath this whole mess? And the answer, no. I think they will it all up. Well, having said that, the piece continues. What's the prediction for monetary policy this year, given the new level of volatility? And from this comment comes the headline, they'll be paralyzed and move too slowly, probably getting the worst of all worlds. This will be bad for the economy, but it could also lead to dramatic political repercussions. The U.S. regime, he didn't spell that word right, has tried to claim otherwise out of some combination of duplicity and stupidity, but inflation is quite regressive. Rich people can only spend so much on food and gas and basic staples. Even filling up a G-Wagon and flying in elk steaks from Wyoming only costs a trivial percentage of their income and wealth. But regular people, especially those on fixed incomes, are getting badly damaged. And the piece notes here, they'll be voting in November. To which all your hosts can add is, yeah, the only question is whether or not they'll be counted. This piece also asks and answers some questions about the war in Ukraine, saying, among other things, who do you think has all the leverage there? And the answer is China. Russia's already committed most of their pre-positioned forces. The Ukrainians are already fighting for their homeland. The West is already helping with the tools to sustain that fight, and if necessary, sustain it behind enemy lines for months, or probably, preferably for those that are selling the weapons, years to come. So most of the direct and secondary players, the piece says, are committed, which leaves China. They could make or break Russia's attack, and they'll certainly exact aggressive terms in return for whatever they commit. And among other things, folks, that means they'll probably get a lot of cheap oil and gas. And I can't help but note, folks, that other analysts have been suggesting for a long time, one of the things China will probably get is California and other big parts of the post-breakdown U.S. that they've already been vying for. With that on the table, I do think it's prudent at this point to go back and take a look at some of the other things that led up to it, more or less chronologically, starting back over the weekend, where I found myself musing about this question. How long would it take before the American people figured out exactly what had happened anyway? How would they even know whether the world economic system had already collapsed? Probably not until, as I've suggested literally for years now, they go into the local Walmart and the shelves are empty. I mean, even $9 a gallon gas doesn't seem to have done it yet. And since there's no mushroom clouds, at least not of the visible kind yet, the masses wander about in their normalcy haze. Nothing's changed inside of our little bubble here, so nothing will. Most are still even wearing their face diapers. Meanwhile, criminally negligent networks tell parents to go ahead and give their kids the Zyklon B injection. Hey, what's the worst that could happen? And keep on hating on Vladimir Putin. Remember George Orwell and the 2 minutes of hate? Well, they've expanded it to a few minutes more than that, but the point remains the same. And ain't it funny that people who don't even know where Ukraine's borders are still think they're so much more important than the ones that are being invaded in the southern United States? They're out there waving their Ukrainian flag right along with their rainbow and unicorn flag. So I'm going to start off today with a whole bunch of stories that the waste stream is utterly clueless about, and most Americans have no idea how they could possibly matter in their little bubbles. This first one falls into what I call the harbinger of things to come category, and it's a little bit inside baseball, so no wonder the waste stream will ignore it. It comes from marketplace.org, and a tip of the hat to Steve Quayle, too, for making the point. Most Americans probably have no clue what the gas neon is used for, except for when they see a sign that says, "Eat at Joe's" or "Open" in the window. But neon signs amount to only a tiny fraction of the world's total supply. Maybe 1 to 2% of total world production, says Richard Benzendahl, who runs a consulting firm that does market research on neon, via this article by Stephanie Hughes on Marketplace, who points out that most of the world's neon is used in a different kind of light source, laser, and they're critical to the manufacturing process for semiconductors. And guess what? Russia and Ukraine are major exporters of neon, much of which is now unavailable. And there's literally a worldwide shortage developing, meaning that the world's chip industry is now facing a critical shortage of supply at a critical time, a moment when it's already stretched to capacity. Said Benzendahl, the excimer laser, which is the high-powered laser that can drill holes through metal and so forth, needs neon. It's also used for etching circuit patterns into silicon wafers. Says Nina Turner, semiconductor analyst with IDC, It's like a puzzle piece. You're taking these different patterns and etching them or putting them down on the wafer. She said the process is used to manufacture about 90% of the chips made today, including those used in cars, memory, and power management systems, all areas where there are already chip shortages. And companies, she suggested, may be downplaying their worry about a neon shortage, but I do think they're putting contingency plans into place as we speak. Problem is, most companies have a couple of months, maybe 3 months tops worth of neon on hand. And they hearken back to 8 years ago, the last time that Russia invaded Ukraine, when neon prices shot up. And it looks like this time around, the shortage may simply be an inability to deliver. And even with Chinese plants capturing and exporting neon, Russia and Ukraine remain critical to the world's supply chain. Cryo and Engineering is located in southern Ukraine in the port city of Odessa, and it exports neon to customers around the world, including the U.S. But it stopped production early in March, and shipments are already delayed. There's even concern that the port might be destroyed, and the logistics will then be much, much harder to restart. One of Steve Quayle's sources provides some more information on the importance of neon in the supply chain, saying that global on-hand supplies at manufacturing companies are only 2 to 3 weeks, and that the secondary and knock-on effects in the USA could amount to the loss of literally tens of millions of jobs, because cars, trucks, just about anything with chips of any type in them may end up halting production. And it would be a forced halt, which an executive order simply can't fix. Because in total, it takes about 26 weeks, almost half a year, to process a silicon wafer. And if you stop production and there's a dry spell, it takes about an equally long time to start things back up again. Bottom line, and here comes this suggestion you've probably heard before, Biden has again poked the bear, shot the United States in the foot, and the sanctions against Russia are destroying the U.S., hurting America, and that seems to be the intent, far more than Russia, as our manufacturing base and high-tech industries are literally being assassinated before our eyes. Don't forget, strategic metals and rare earths and things like neon are all part of the equation that the idiots in the swamp simply don't care about. And arguably, that gives them the benefit of the doubt. And by the way, this might affect some defense contractors too. The day of the Fed's long-anticipated rate hike announcement, and ironically, the day after Beware the Ides of March, saw a whole bunch of economic and, of course, related news, because ultimately it all is. And I couldn't help but think that this portion of the recap should be called the Let's Go Brandon update, starting with the producer price numbers out of the Bureau's of Lying Statistics, which have still managed to break all new records, soaring to 10%, the largest year-over-year increase in U.S. history, up 0.2 percentage points just over the last month, another record for the Communist Chinese Party marionette-in-chief, and as Jim Hoff puts it for the Gateway Pundit, they just seem to keep piling up. And note, of course, that the producer price index gauges the price of wholesale goods, which are eventually, and it won't take very long this time around, you can rest assured, passed down to consumers. And a very much related story from the same source, Saudi Arabia on Tuesday, yep, beware the Ides of March, announced they were considering accepting the Chinese yuan in place of the U.S. dollar for future international financial transactions. Guess that helps explain why they wouldn't take calls from the puppet handlers. And this action by Saudi Arabia, and others very much like it, as your host and many, many others have been talking about for a long time now, will end U.S. fiat dollar global currency supremacy. And it was facilitated by the communist Chinese puppet himself, creepy quid pro Joe Biden, and the far-left communist whose Bolshevik revolution over a year ago now was obviously successful. And now we're starting to see the harvest of the wicked fruit that comes from it. And we have a brief follow-up, too, on the story about the London Metals Exchange and how the Communist Chinese seem to have put a wooden stake in that one, too. After reopening nickel trading, they were forced to quickly halt again on limit down, and they're calling it a system error. What a debacle, said Ole Hansen, head of commodity strategy at Saxo Bank. The LME is just not doing itself any favors. And after reopening the London Metal Exchange for nickel trading on Wednesday morning, following the bailout of Chinese commodity tycoon Zhang Guangda, the Chinese-owned exchange was forced to suspend trading again soon after the opening due to what they called a system error, which led to some trades being executed below the new price limits laid out by the exchange. And as Bloomberg reports, only 206 lots, or just a little over 1,200 tons of nickel, managed to change hands before the market was forced to stop trading within seconds on Wednesday morning. Not to worry, though. The LME said they're going to go back and cancel all of those trades. And this, after the London Metals Exchange had already suspended nickel trading for more than a week. And in case you missed the significance of all of this, LME's decision to shut down trading, said Christopher Balding, China economist and a senior fellow at the Henry Jackson Society, is going to be litigated for a long, long time. Let me repeat this, he said. The LME, a major global commodity exchange, shut down trading in nickel so that a Chinese company wouldn't go bankrupt, he tweeted. And because the Hong Kong Exchange owns the London Metals Exchange, guess who owns HKEX? First letter's a C, last letter's a P, and I don't have to tell you the middle one, he said. But hint, folks, your host adds, they're pulling some puppet strings in the swamp, too. And the Hong Kong Exchange has owned LME since 2012. Here's the key, folks, and you're going to see this in a lot of the metals markets. Probably your host has suggested for a long time now, especially the precious metals, paper-driven markets. The underlying metals behind the nickel exchange, says the piece here, are increasingly decoupling from the real market. And after all of that, let's not forget that Wednesday is Fed decision day. Yeah, the FOMC is widely expected to hike interest rates a quarter point, and just keep on doing that, backing up until they hear glass breaking. And here's the irony, folks. They seem to be deaf because the glass has been broken for quite a while now. And since prior to that announcement, about the only thing happening in the markets is the usual suppression of paper, gold, and silver prices, let's take a look at several analyses of what's happening. From Zero Hedge, who notes again that today's the day the Fed is expected to hike rates by 25 basis points, its first hike since December 2018, and the first liftoff from zero since December of 2015. Note that in his recent testimony to Congress, Fed Chairman Powell summed up the compromise that the FOMC appears to have reached by noting that he'll support that quarter point hike at the March meeting, but he's open to hiking even more than that at future meetings if inflation surprises to the upside. Oh, gee, do you think? Maybe what they're saying now is that nobody who's been paying attention could be surprised by hyperinflation or remains persistently high or even out of control. To be sure, continues Tyler Durden, many are already asking why just 25 basis points. After all, the last time inflation was at 7.9%, it's never been this high, the Fed funds rate was at 15%. The answer? Never before has the U.S. financial system been so hyper-financialized. And they say any rushed attempt to lift interest rates will lead to a complete collapse in risk assets. Rabobank's Michael Every suggests that the news out of Saudi Arabia and the petro yuan suggests China is preparing for U.S. sanctions, and he begins by reminding us, yep, it's FOMC or Fed decision day, but the changing world we live in means this really isn't even the most important thing going on. At least it's not what people are talking about the most. Let's start with the ivory tower thinkers, or emoters, maybe your host suggests, in the D.C. swamp. From Philip Mary, who writes, hiking season, and notes, starting a hiking cycle in the midst of a geopolitical crisis may seem counterintuitive, but for the Fed, the Russian invasion of Ukraine and all the subsequent sanctions are essentially an additional negative supply shock. Which is exactly, says Every, what the market is pricing in by calling for 7 rate hikes this year, although Philip says he expects only 4, which makes a lot more sense if you consider just how much money is being sucked out of the U.S. economy by rising inflation. I'll add that his title and that backdrop reminds me of the Bugs Bunny Daffy Duck cartoon where each tries to persuade the hunter Elmer Fudd that it's either rabbit season or duck season, before all of them end up finding out that it's in fact Elmer Fudd season. So he says, given how disastrous rate hikes are going to turn out to be in what is now a war economy, it'll be the central banks in the firing line in time. Indeed, he notes, continuing his article, all of the conversations today revolve around the war. And after a summary on that score, he adds that many people in that region worry that the present U.S. policy path will end up with the war, and maybe he's drinking the Kool-Aid here, wants to avoid, just as Ukraine did. No, they don't want to avoid the war, folks. They've been jonesing for this for a long time, and they're still working really hard to make sure it becomes a fait accompli. But then he gets back to brass tacks, saying, meanwhile, the geopolitics markets and the world there just keeps on turning. Yesterday, the EU endorsed a plan to slap import levies on iron and steel, cement and aluminum produced in countries with lower environmental standards, the so-called CBAM, or Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism, which still needs to go before the EU Parliament. But hey, think about more green protectionism and what that'll mean. North Korea just launched another possible ICBM, taking it ever closer to having a nuke that could hit hit the U.S.? Could that be dollar negative? And apart from all the hoo-ha over oil, in Brazil, potash prices are going up like a rocket. They're up 238% year over year. U.S. Corn Belt ammonia looks almost the same, up 127% year over year, as does Egypt urea spot, up 175% year over year. And if this is sustained, it certainly means higher global food prices, especially priced in dollars rather than Chinese yuan. Michael Snyder at the Economic Collapse blog reminds us again just how catastrophic the collapse of the U.S. petrodollar will end up being for American peons, saying that the economic sanctions that have been imposed upon Russia have caused immense damage, but the loss of the petrodollar would be absolutely devastating for the U.S. economy, or what's left of it. Since making an agreement with the Nixon administration back in 1974, the Saudis have traded oil exclusively for U.S. dollars. Today, approximately 80% of all oil produced in the entire world is traded for dollars, and the petrodollar has thus become one of the foundational pillars of the current global financial system, cracking as it may be. Most Americans don't realize this, but far more dollars are actually, though, used outside of the United States than in it. And having the reserve currency for the world is a massive advantage for us while it lasts, because up until this point, there has been an insatiable demand for U.S. dollars all over the planet, which has allowed Americans to enjoy a standard of living way above what we actually deserve. And unfortunately, all of that is about to change. As he and many of us have stated many times over the last year, Joe Biden is surrounded by the worst foreign policy team, and that's not all, folks, in U.S. history. And that's really saying something. So thanks to the catastrophically bad foreign policy team, our relations with both Saudi Arabia and China have greatly deteriorated, resulting in them developing closer relations with one another. In fact, the Wall Street Journal is reporting it looks like the Saudis could start pricing oil that sells to China and the Chinese currency, the renminbi or yuan. And that means the U.S. dollar, says the WSJ, may be on its way out as world global reserve currency, which would be a catastrophic blow to the United States, and the Saudis know it. Maybe, says Michael Snyder, Biden shouldn't have called Saudi Arabia a pariah, and maybe his foreign policy team shouldn't have angered the Saudis so many times over the last 12 months. But hey, folks, let's be realistic here. For crying out loud, who hasn't this regime tried to really piss off? The Chinese, though, still seem to understand the art of diplomacy. It helps to have a puppet in the White House, too. And they're reportedly offering, quote, everything you could possibly imagine for the Saudis to decide to make this move. Said a Saudi official familiar with the talks, the dynamics have dramatically changed. The U.S. relationship with the Saudis has changed. China is the world's biggest crude importer, and they're offering many lucrative incentives to the kingdom. And just maybe, he adds as well, now we know why MBS wasn't taking creepy quid pro Joe's phone calls. At one time, the Chinese may have been afraid to threaten U.S. interests so openly, but not anymore. And that was certainly before they took over the White House. Snyder goes on to explain how one of the worst imbeciles in a regime full of them, National Security Advisor Sick Jake Sullivan, has made clear during talks with his Chinese counterpart on Monday that the U.S. has, quote, deep concerns about China's alignment with who else? Russia at this time. I mean, really, folks, just who does he think's going to be buying all that Russian oil that Biden told him to go put where the sun don't shine? And obviously now that means Beijing. Sullivan ought to have deep concerns, says Snyder, because he was one of the key idiots that helped create this mess. And by the way, he's deeply disliked all over the globe, and it certainly isn't an accident that he was just now put on the list of U.S. officials that the Russians sanctioned on Tuesday, including the Marionette-in-Chief, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, Secretary of Defense Sick Lloyd Austin, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Chinese puppet Mark Milley, along with a host of others, including the aforementioned National Security Advisor, CIA Director, White House Press Secretary, and a whole list of others, including crackhead son Joe Biden, along with the Deputy Treasury Secretary, the President and Chairman of the Board of Directors for the Ex-Im Bank, and former Secretary of State, yes, Hitlery herself. While it may have been a symbolic move by the Russians, because they won't really hurt anybody on that list, another move that Putin made this week certainly will cause a bit of pain for the Western world. On Monday, Putin signed a law that would allow Russian airlines to take control of hundreds of Western-built planes leased from international firms, said Russian news agency TASS for the Wall Street Journal. I guess if you're going to steal from them, they got stuff they can steal right on back. The jets will be added to the country's aircraft register and be deployed on domestic routes, according to Reuters. And that news came on the heels of the little island of Bermuda revoking the airworthiness certificates for over 700 leased aircraft in Russia, which went into effect over the weekend. Basically, Western powers and the Russians are both now escalating hand over fist the economic war that's obviously already in progress. Previous administrations, concludes Snyder, have emphasized and defended the importance of the petrodollar. They're often willing to go to very great lengths to defend it, but now the Biden regime is trying to put a wooden stake in it, for reasons that your host at least suggests have been obvious for quite a while now. And you already know that the bad guys call it the Great Reset.
It's a wonder I can think at all. And my lack of education hasn't hurt me none. I can read the writing on the wall.
Welcome back now to the second segment for this evening. I'm still your host, Mark Call. And let's start this one off with a brief Zyklon B injection update. And first, courtesy of the Gateway Pundit, the world's number two female golfer and 2020 Olympic gold medalist Nelly Korda announced on Sunday she was diagnosed with blood clots and is recovering at her home in Florida. The 23-year-old golfer announced on social media that she developed blood clots and then noticed it when she felt swelling in her arm and went to the emergency room on the recommendation of her doctor. The cause of the clots, say the stories, is allegedly unknown. No further information has been released, but reportedly she was at least vaccinated ahead of the 2020 Summer Olympics in Tokyo, Japan. An Australian cricket legend named Shane Wayne died of a heart attack just over a week ago while on vacation at what was called a boys' holiday in Thailand. The 52-year-old legend was found unresponsive in his hotel room by one of his friends. He was rushed to Thai International Hospital and pronounced dead shortly thereafter. Turns out, Shane Wayne was an advocate for the COVID-19 Zyklon B injection and for wearing his face mask. And he received two doses of the Zyklon B not vaccine and still managed to get infected by the virus last August. But don't you know, folks, all of this would have been much worse if he hadn't taken the poison poke. Another Aussie, this time it's a Labor senator named Kimberly Kitching of Melbourne, died suddenly after the poison poke at age 52. And in St. Louis County, Missouri, Cora Faith Walker, age 37, who was a pro-vaccine county leader and former Missouri state representative, died suddenly after, you know what. Justin Bieber's celebrity wife Haley was hospitalized recently for a, quote, small blood clot in her brain, which gave her stroke-like symptoms. That one's all over the web, but amazingly, you won't find the word vaccine so much as hinted at in any of the major waste stream coverage. Evidently, $1 billion of propaganda fiat still has a long ways to go. This headline, though, from People magazine was at least revealing. Blood clots, it says, like Hailey Bieber's, are happening in, quote, younger and younger people. And they went to a prominent vascular neurologist who explains how blood clots can form and the stroke-like symptoms to look out for. And here comes the sin of omission, your host suggests. The so-called doctor, Dr. Shazam Hussein, went through a list of the, quote, different reasons that blood clots might form and potential risk factors you might have, like high cholesterol, difficulty with sugars, but not so much as a hint of, yeah, the Zyklon B injection or the boosters. And if you think about it, folks, this is almost hilarious. Dr. Hussein suggested that this could run in families. People's blood might have a tendency to clot, especially if the whole family has taken the clot shot. Which brings me to several more, certainly not high profile, at least so far as the waste stream is concerned, although TGP thinks they're important. An 8-year-old boy from Peru was diagnosed with Stevens-Johnson syndrome just days after receiving his second dose of the Pfizer COVID-19 not vaccine. The young boy suffered a horrific adverse reaction after getting his second dose of the poison poke on February 21 of this year. He had hives all over his body and has been in two different hospitals since. Currently, he's in a children's hospital in Lima being treated in the burn unit for his skin condition, which continues to progressively worsen. The father said he didn't know the vaccine was experimental and was all but forced into giving it to his son, given the threat of him not being able to attend classes without it. And now he needs an operation because he's not able to urinate. TGP quoted one study published on the NIH website about Stevens-Johnson syndrome following the second dose of the COVID-19 not vaccine, admitting that it is a, quote, potential complication which can be associated with COVID-19 vaccination, but it's rare, they say, and the benefits of receiving the vaccination outweigh the potential harms.
That's my story and I'm sticking to it.
Unquote, unless, obviously, the patient dies or is permanently disabled. And let's not forget, folks, when it comes to recognizing BS like that, this is a so-called vaccine that really isn't, with potentially deadly or debilitating side effects, which doesn't really prevent, anyway, a condition that just basically doesn't bother 8-year-old kids. I gotta say it again, just how sick are the perverted child abusers who mandate crap like this for kids? Or for that matter, I have to note, who knowingly allow it to be done to their own children. Which brings us to this tragic story about a 12-year-old girl from Brazil named Pietra Procopio Aguiar, who died in her sleep reportedly as a result of a heart attack and a seizure, according to her mother, who, quote, still doesn't know what happened. Pietra was always a healthy child, never had any neurological or heart problems that we were aware of, she wrote on social media. Yes, she was vaccinated, the mother admitted, but we'll only know what really happened after the report in 30 days. And some of us folks, based on an understanding of what's happening here, are really skeptical that we'll know anything more, especially nothing more that's true, once that report comes out. Oh, and while we're kind of sort of on the topic, can anybody really say that being a homosexual far-left celebrity doesn't have its perks? Convicted hate crime hoaxer Jesse Smollett was recently sentenced to a pitiful 150 days in jail for his famous international high-profile felony back in January 2019. Remember how he paid a couple of his bathhouse buddies to pretend to be Trump-supporting MAGA racists, whereupon he put a noose around his own neck and then sent cops on a multi-million-dollar snipe hunt hoax. It was, however, ineptly executed. Anybody with half a brain, and that excludes most of Hollywood, and certainly most of the swamp, could and did readily see through it. Jesse was eventually caught and convicted of, get this, felony disorderly conduct, for which he never showed the slightest hint of remorse and kept screaming, I'm innocent! I'm innocent! Oh, and he's not suicidal either, he kept screaming, although he may be insane. Because anything a leftist does, especially if he's gay, is justified, don't you know? Especially if it's truly incredible, hypocritical, real racism. So, we were told, Jesse finally sees justice done, although, obviously, not really. And certainly not for long. Smollett was convicted on 5 counts, says the Daily Mail's coverage, of 5 counts of felony disorderly conduct in December after a jury found he did lie to police in January 2019 and then repeatedly thereafter claiming he was attacked by 2 white homophobic Trump supporters in January 2019. In reality, they were black brothers and more paid for by Smollett to carry out the criminal sham in an attempt to raise his celebrity profile. What's even remotely newsworthy about all this, you might be asking? Well, Jesse Smollett was released from jail Wednesday night, spawning a wave, says the Daily Mail, of disbelief, outrage, and mockery of the entire case against the so-called actor, many considering it the latest episode in a long-running farce that still, your host notes, seems to have no end in sight. Oh, and get this. Jesse can't be hospitalized, says his family, who filed an emergency motion. He can't be in jail because he's immunocompromised. Does that mean he's taken the poison poke and all the required boosters? And he's at risk of booga, 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 COVID. Isn't it funny, folks? Everybody else has been in jail for 2 years because of COVID. He's the only one that can't stay there for the same reason. Now he's out, and people are rightfully saying, hey, what kind of justice is this in post-constitutional, post-biblical, post-rule of law America? Answer? Oh, yeah. It's not only been writ large for a long time now, and they're not only rubbing people's noses in it, they're shoving our entire face down into the muck. Still, though, the Daily Mail did post some pretty good comments about it. One of them said, if you live in Chicago, please be careful. The hate crime criminal who attacked Jesse Smollett was released from jail last night. And yeah, guess whose tearful picture was right under that? And another added, please, please, please be very careful out there when you make your 3 a.m. subway run. Next thing you know, Biden will nominate him for the Supreme Court. And you know what? As I think about it, I only wish I was kidding. But I'll tell you what, folks, if he comes out as trans, you'll know the fix is in. As regular listeners here know, your host has contended for quite some time that the real effort behind so many of the cover-ups, including the attempt to foment World War III, has to do with the impending massive, biggest meltdown of a once global fiat currency in world history, associated with the biggest debt bubble in history to boot. And now that it's all coming apart at the seams and the die is cast, Big Brother and his minions at the unconstitutional Federal Reserve need a scapegoat to divert attention and take the blame. COVID-1984 is one obvious candidate, as is Russia, and their evil dictator, Vladimir Putin. Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. He's the guy that's really causing the massive hyperinflation. One of the fellows who called this shot early on was Credit Suisse contributing analyst Zoltan Pozsar, who identified the Fed's exploding repo madness back in September of 2019, just coincidentally right before COVID-19 had to come on the scene and distract people from what was going on right then and there. And with Big Brother's intended overreaction, not to mention putting a wooden stake in the heart of the economy. Last week he raised a lot of eyebrows in a piece where he said we're witnessing the birth, and here comes the article's title, of Bretton Woods III, a new world monetary order centered around commodity-based currencies in the East, yeah, not the West anymore, that will likely weaken the euro-dollar system and contribute to inflationary forces in the West. A crisis, he said, is unfolding. It's a crisis of commodities, which are collateral, and collateral is money, and this crisis is about the rising allure of what he calls outside money over inside money. Bretton Woods II, World War II era, was built on inside money, and the foundations of that, he said, crumbled a week ago when the G7 seized Russia's foreign exchange reserves. So the beautiful paradox of linear rates, the stuff you and I trade and write about, is that you need to think linear and find relative value most of the time, but you have to think nonlinear in order to recognize and survive regime shifts like the one we're now in. We're seeing a regime shift unfold in funding markets currently, which, as always, he says, will pass, and a sea change in inflation dynamics and foreign exchange reserve management practices. And here he gets a little bit inside baseball about spreads and freight shipping rates, which boil down, in part at least, to an understanding of arbitrage. We've seen a crisis of sorts unfolding, he says, and in a crisis, like in 2008, everyone lends at short maturities, and that puts pressure on longer premiums. What drives the bid for cash, he asks, i.e., whose bid is driving term funding premia in this environment where lenders are less willing to lend cash for longer tenors? The commodities world, he answers, for three reasons. First, non-Russian commodities are more expensive due to the sanctions-driven supply shock that basically took Russian commodities offline. So if you're a leveraged commodities trader, you need to borrow more from banks to buy commodities to move and then sell them. Secondly, if you're long Russian commodities and short the related futures, you're likely having margin calls that need to be funded. Anyone in the commodities world is experiencing a perfect storm as correlations suddenly shot to one, which is never a good thing. But that's precisely what happens when the West sanctions the single largest commodity producer in the world, which sells virtually everything. And what we're seeing at the 50-year anniversary of the 1973 OPEC supply shock is something similar, but substantially worse. The 2022 Russian supply shock, which isn't driven by the supplier, but by the consumer, who evidently has chosen not to consume at all, at least not to consume until it really hurts him. Thus, if you're short Russian commodities and long the related futures, then you're likely having margin calls, too, that need to be funded, just like above. If you see the pattern I see, he says, you should be concerned, in part because commodities no longer trade at par. There are Russian commodities that are collapsing in price and non-Russian commodities that are rallying. That's due to the Russia 2022 supply shock that we referred to above, which once again is driven by present and future sanctions-related stigma. In other words, I like this, it's a buyer's strike, not a seller's strike, to make things all the more absurd. The problem is we don't have a backstop. Somebody needs to provide a backstop, he says, which brings us to today, the present, and shipping freight rates. If we're right, and this is in fact a crisis of commodities, a kind of a 2008 of sorts thematically, if not in terms of size or severity, well then who will provide the backstop? We look around, we see but only one entity, the People's Bank of China. Western central banks, he says, can't do it. They can't close the gap on the commodities basis because their respective sovereigns, and you got to wonder which one is driving who, are the ones driving the sanctions. They'll have to deal with the inflationary impacts of the commodities basis and try to cool them with rate hikes, but they'll not be able to provide the outside spreads and won't be able to provide balance sheets to close Russia, not Russia, spreads. And commodity traders won't be able to do so either. But, he says, after some more analysis, the People's Bank of China can, as it banks for a sovereign who can dance to its own tune. But to make things more complicated, China is probably thinking deep and hard about the value of the inside money claims in their foreign exchange reserves, now that the G7 has seized Russia's. From here, I turn to Tom Luongo via his Gold, Goats, and Guns blog. Zero Hedge posted it as well, who notes that every investor in the world should read Zoltan Poser's note about the birth of a new Bretton Woods agreement. People mostly freaked out about this, he says, are the Keynesians who worship at the altar of what Poser calls inside money, money that exists only inside the financial system, things like bonds, credit, dollars, euros, etc. While Austrians, and that would include not only the author here, Tom Luongo, but your host, Murray Rothbard, Ludwig von Mises, and Ron Paul, and lots of others that I quote frequently on these news shows. And by the way, it also includes what your host calls biblical economics as well, have always understood, says Luongo, that eventually inside money fails because it's ultimately nothing more than a Ponzi scheme built on top of outside money. What's that? Money that exists outside the financial system. Things like commodities, meaning gold, silver, wheat, grain, and oil. And, of course, even new things like Bitcoin. Poser makes his early case, then goes through the mechanics of what's happening in the financial plumbing of the world economy right now to prove that the stresses are real and they're building quickly towards an implosion of that inside money and an explosion of outside money. Anyone, he says, with a passing acquaintance with Austrian business cycle theory and Mises' theory of money and credit always knew that this day was coming. But today's inside money standard, known colloquially as the dollar reserve standard, is actually what I like to call Milton Friedman's nightmare because, as Luongo says, it's nothing more than a system of competitively devalued and inflated debt-based scripts running around drinking each other's milkshakes until everyone's glass is empty. And by the way, there's a world full of empty glasses right now. More being created every day as the financial system turns predatory after the Lehman Brothers collapse that presaged a lot of this back in 2008. It was then, he says, that the central banksters and governments turned fully against the people sucking up more and more outside money by inflating inside money egregiously in order to control more and more of the real wealth of the world. There's only one problem with that, though. Eventually, you run out of, as Maggie Thatcher put it, other people's money. As Luongo says, you run out of property based on outside money to squeeze out of people's hands. The more you take, the less people are actually restrained by trivial things like laws. And eventually, two things happen. The first we've seen for a number of years from Russia and China for the past dozen, steady accumulation of gold and other hard assets, outside money, including the building of real manufacturing infrastructure as well as the financial infrastructure to house it. And the second is just over the horizon, the moment when all legal claims to controlling outside money mean nothing, when enforcement of those legal claims gets exposed as a bluff, because there just aren't enough enforcers capable of keeping the looters from taking it. Look, he says, I'm as much of a private property guy as you can possibly conceive of, but I made peace a long time ago with what those claims of private property actually mean, in the very real sense to me personally, and my limits of defending them. Basically, he says, I might lay claim to ownership of hundreds of acres of land. I can even have a deed that proves I bought it from someone who also had a legal document to ownership. That's legal ownership. But real ownership is actually being able to defend that claim by constantly applying your time and energy. I live rural, folks. I can tell you that where the roads lie and where the legal property corners are don't necessarily square with each other. And the reality is, when you live like that, little things simply aren't worth your time. But if you're a stickler for this stuff, that means, for example, rousting squatters, pressing claims of borders if people cut the corner, driving along the public easement, etc., and you want to spend your money and you have the time, fine. You put up the fence or the poles or the signs, and you have to police that claim. But if you don't, do you really still have claim to that property? Legally, yes, but de facto, no, Be honest with yourself. Libertarian theorists have juggled with this question for years. Naturally, it comes down, as Hoppe would put it, to the private production of defense. How willing are you to continue pressing that claim over property that you're not effectively mixing your labor with? If not, you're going to end up having to let go of it anyway, he says. And I realize this opens up a massive can of philosophical worms, but that's the point I'm trying to make. When civilization breaks down, legal claims tend towards zero value. And civilization, he adds, breaks down through the systemic subversion of the agreed-upon rules, and isn't this what we're seeing today, folks, to the advantage of some, you can name the names now, can't you, at the expense of others. And what bigger subversion of this rule, thou shalt not steal, could there be than a debt-based Ponzi scheme of inside money being used to suck up all the legal claims to most of the world's valuable resources while actively suppressing the value of the competing outside money to defend people's claims to it. And this, he said, is what Posner's talking about when he says we're moving away from inside money to outside money. Inside money is created through rules and laws, not markets. But outside money is created through labor, time, and human ingenuity. It is, in fact, tokenized human capital. And that's the real implication of Posner's note that we're approaching a new Bretton Woods where outside money will replace inside money as a reserve asset, at least in the East, of the financial system. But the West has stupidly picked a fight with the one country, Russia, that has the commodities needed to run the world and bring about this return to an outside money-based system. So Posner rightly argues that the inside money system only works if commodities trade within tight spreads, i.e. almost zero geographic arbitrage. In other words, it's worth something in Kansas and something pretty much the same in Ukraine. That's another way of saying this shit money is only worth using if everyone has confidence in the system, because commodity prices are not under real systemic stress. It works because everyone still believes, and he adds wrongly, that the rules of civilization are mostly equitable and it's possible to defend your property through its institutions. We've seen this over years. Individual commodity markets can be subject to the vicissitudes of living, boom and bust cycles, weather, etc. But when the entire commodity system complex is under stress, like it is now, that ends up being a no-confidence vote against the inside money system. And he says that's what we witnessed, and it broke last week with the London Metals Exchange shutting down futures trading in nickel. There was one Chinese tycoon who was caught massively short. His counterparty turned out to be one of the most systemically important banksters in the world, J.P. Morgan Chase. And moreover, he says the LME didn't reopen because that guy didn't want to cover his short. Instead, doubled down. So now the LME is trying to reverse all the trades that occurred on Wednesday. In other words, rules for thee and not for me. Oh, look, someone thought that all that inside money was actually worth something to claim outside money in the real world. How quaint. So let's connect the dots, he says. And maybe everybody's forgotten this, but who actually owns the London Metals Exchange? It ain't London. It ain't New York. It's China. And they bought it 10 years ago. And here's where Tom Longo suggests the plot really thickens. For those wondering when China was going to make its move to support Russia in this financial World War III, I think it happened on March 8th when they shut down the London Metals Exchange. What do I mean by this? Well, let's set the Wayback Machine to last year. Anybody remember the Archegos Capital debacle? Bill Wang's ridiculous one-way portfolio of CFDs for momentum meme stocks, which pulled nearly every Western prime broker into a vortex so powerful it shook the entire financial system to its core. Back then, I noted, just prior to Archegos blowing up, that Ukraine had declared war on Russia by making it Ukrainian security policy to retake Crimea, along with prominent members of the U.S. State Department calling Taiwan a country. So I asked the following question. If you were the Chinese and you were now in a hybrid war with the U.S., how would you send a message back across the Pacific? Answer, by blowing up a test financial nuke like Archegos, was my conclusion. So now here we are, a year later, and World War III has gone hot in Ukraine. The West is screaming at Russia for abrogating so-called legal agreements in the UN Charter, while the Russians watch the US and NATO unilaterally pull out of such treaties previously under the last three presidents, knowing full well that so-called legal claims to anything at this point aren't worth squat if they cannot be enforced. And this war with Ukraine is a clear manifestation of what he called his second point, the moment when all legal claims to controlling outside money and stealing that real wealth through inside money mean nothing if those legal claims get exposed as a bluff. and Russia just called it. So the real question, he suggests, is what are the Chinese now going to do about all of this? And they may have just done it. Why would the LME allow this guy to amass this insane position in nickel futures when he clearly isn't interested in taking delivery of the metal? Which, back when the markets were honest, was the point of futures exchanges. But just maybe, China wants to allow pittance of newly minted inside money to blow up the whole nickel market, and with it, the validity of the LME as a futures exchange. It's nickel today, but will it be gold tomorrow? And Posar gave us the clues with his note. And given that global financial markets are dependent on the fiction of paper gold, call it inside gold if you like, while China has their own well-established Shanghai market for gold and oil, it's not hard to see how China can now blow this whole thing up. Meanwhile, the FOMC is facing their existential choice this week. Just how much do we raise rates in the U.S. knowing the deflationary shock it will have on asset prices, especially since the ECB just signaled they're getting on the tightening bandwagon? Now Biden et al. Are looking for ways to freeze Russia's gold so they can spend it. They killed Gaddafi and stole his gold, but he didn't have nukes. You can guess where all of this probably will end up. It's just starting to get really interesting, folks, so pay attention and try not to be deceived.